I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. An interesting conversation ahead. Our guest has written and does workshops about what it means to be white in a society that proclaims race meaningless, yet is deeply divided by race. She is Dr. Robin DiAngelo. She's a former associate professor of multicultural education. Her scholarship is in whiteness studies. She's been honored several times with a Student's Choice Award for Educator of the Year. She serves as Director of Equity at Senior Services and has many publications. Just released her second book, What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy. Previous work is Everyone Really Equal? An Introduction to Key Concepts in Social Justice Education. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about these challenging issues this hour of the program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Robin, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. You have said that you grew up poor and white, but that for your experience of poverty, it would have been different had you not been white. What do you mean?
Well, I'm very, very clear that to be poor and white and to be poor and black, for example, is not the same experience because poor black people are also dealing with racism, and I wasn't, and not being a person of color, being white, definitely helped me navigate that poverty, move out of it, and now be seen as fitting in. It's only internal that I have that class difference. And so, in fact, white privilege played a key role in me changing my condition.
Mm-hmm. We hear that term, white privilege. Tell me what it means. Mm-hmm.
It means that society is set up in a way that automatically advantages you if you are white. It's not dependent on your self-image or your intentions or your beliefs, that it's simply structured in a way that will reflect your image, your experience. Maybe a clear example would be picture an escalator, you know, in a large building, and people are on the escalator, and someone is, you know, uses a wheelchair and doesn't have access to that means. The people on the escalator, you know, aren't bad. They didn't intend to exclude him, but the structure of the building automatically does do that. So they are advantaged by the way the building is structured in a way that the person using the wheelchair is not. And that can help a little bit with the defensiveness or the guilt about that advantage. It's just handed to you. Maybe another example might be that clearly Bill Gates's son has advantages that probably your average listener's son doesn't have. Regardless of how hard folks work, it's built into the society.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty heavily built into the society, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Multiple levels. And that's the other key challenge. Well, there are many key challenges talking about race and racism, particularly for white people. But one is this really simple idea that it's a matter of conscious dislike. And if I don't have conscious dislike, there's no dislike that I'm aware of that I have towards people of color, I couldn't possibly be part of this system, or I couldn't be benefiting, or I couldn't be perpetrating. And it's so far beyond that. It's so much deeper than that, and it's multi-leveled and layered.
Mm-hmm. We had an interesting conversation about schools in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin last hour, and we had somebody call about a school board election in an African-American candidate in a district that has a significant number of African-American students, but the difficulty in getting a person of color elected to that board because it tends to be a white-run kind of place, as many schools are, not necessarily in Milwaukee, which is a heavily African-American district. I want to talk about this issue of racial segregation, not only in our schools, but also in our neighborhoods, which seems to me, Robin, to be still very pronounced in this country. We live with people who are sort of like us when it comes to color. We have schools that are markedly segregated now, even though we have tried to desegregate them. They're more segregated now than they have been in a long period of time. What does all of that do? What is the impact of racial segregation on the issue of white privilege, on the issue of racism in our country?
I think the impact is profound. I think it may be the deepest and most profound message of all. To be told that everyone's equal, but to live separately from them, so that the actual practice of our lives does not reflect the values that we profess. And there is a common way that we like to explain that, which is it's just human nature. People just like to be with their
right.
own. And I patently reject that, because for as long as we have been segregated, people of color have tried to integrate with us. And there have just been decades of policies and practices that have prevented them from doing so. And I just don't think it's natural that some people like to be with their own with all the resources, and other people prefer to be separate without the resources. It's a structured dynamic that white people use and wield. We live the most segregated lives. We choose that segregation, and we tend to talk about segregated spaces that are white as good, as safe. Those are incredibly powerful messages about ourselves, about our place, and about our relationship. And those messages are not lost on children. And the other impact is that we don't actually know what's going on. We don't know the reality of people of color's lives. We don't tend to have a variety of authentic, sustained relationships with people of color. And so we're very susceptible to deeply problematic representations of them, and explanations for why things are unequal. And yet we're most likely to be at the table making decisions that are going to affect their lives. And all of this comes together in very problematic ways.
Mm-hmm. So how do we go about making better decisions at that table?
Well, to be really honest, we have to be honest. I think that there is a deeply anti-black sentiment in this country, in the collective white conscious. Most bias is implicit, not explicit. So these dynamics that I just mentioned set us up to be conditioned, if you will, into a fairly negative view of African Americans in particular, that we can't admit to ourselves because it doesn't align with our maybe conscious beliefs. And so there's this deeply internalized sense of superiority, deeply internalized implicit bias against, in this case, African Americans, all of which we can't admit to or won't admit to, and may even not be consciously aware of, the bulk of it. And now we're sitting at the tables. So we have to want to be direct. We have to push through a lot of apathy, and maybe at one level below that, a lot of resentment that they should have something that we see as that we're entitled to. There's also a deep investment in schools being unequal. If I want my child to have the very best, someone else is not going to have the very best, right? We fight really intensely for schools and the ones, you know, that our children are going to go to. And I think we have to ask ourselves, why is it okay for somebody's children to have an inferior education but not mine? And in fact, mine couldn't have a superior one if someone else doesn't have an inferior one. So there's a lot of resistance to equality, and all of that is operating with those folks at the table. We can also add the layer of defensiveness at any suggestion. I can already imagine how your listeners are reacting, right? Defensiveness at any suggestion that we would be, you know, invested in this system, or that we would have bias that we may not be aware of. And so that makes it very hard when we do get people of color at the table to actually hear what they're saying, especially if they challenge us, right? Or they say, hey, the way you're talking about this policy is actually really problematic racially. We don't tend to be receptive to that. We get defensive, and pretty soon we kind of push them out and go for people that will keep us more comfortable around all of these dynamics.
Mm. Because we're sensing that people are saying that we individually are racist and we only look at this as an individual thing. Oh, no, I'm not racist. I, as an individual, am not racist. But you can't see beyond yourself to these other areas that you've been talking about.
Yes, and you also can't be, well, I can't say can't, but it's very difficult to take an honest look at the racism you indeed do have. I, you know, I've committed my life to this work and to racial justice, and I've been deeply conditioned into a racist worldview because we live in a racist society. It's the water we're swimming in, and I'll spend my life trying to challenge it, but every moment that I push against it, the messages are coming right back at me. And I think the most brilliant adaptation of racism post-civil rights was to make being a good moral person and complicity with racism mutually exclusive. Good people could not and were not a part of racism. And so when you suggest that we are, we actually hear that as a moral insult, a character slight, and we must defend our character. And so we respond with a denial and deflection, again, because we've been taught that it's simply a matter of conscious dislike, and the people that hold that are bad, and the people that don't are good. And we would be bad people if we were part of this, right? And mm-hmm. So it's just kind of, it's a perfect setup. I think it's actually what I call it the good-bad binary. I think it's actually a perfect way to hold racism in place and to protect those perspectives and biases we have, because it makes it virtually impossible to talk to us about racism. Hmm. White people are incredibly defensive about racism.
So you have spent years and made this your life's work. When you come to there, I have been looking at this anti-racist checklist for whites that mm-hmm. was adapted in 2009 for anti-racist white allies. Mm-hmm. And one of the items on the checklist is I raise issues about racism over and over, both in public and in private. Because you do this all the time and you teach this, how do you do that on a daily basis? What issues do you bring up over and over?
Well, if you, and I think I just want to, I want to explain a little bit the over and over, because it might sound like somebody's just constantly or a broken record. The point is that we don't give up and we don't back off, because getting racism on the table is really, really difficult. And there's a lot of pressure the moment it gets on the table to push it back off the table. This is why people will immediately go, well, let's look at class. I think it's really all about class or economics, and mm-hmm. if we solve economics. That's why I talk about being poor and being white, to push against this idea that if we, you know, eliminated class inequality, we would eliminate racism. And while they're deeply connected, they're not the same. So I lost my thought there. Ask me the question again. Oh, bringing it up.
Bring it up, yes.
Yeah, so,
just bring
so you,
it
have
up.
To, you have to have commitment and tenacity to keep at it and to resist all of the different kind of moves that people will make to silence that discussion. So that's getting at that I have the courage and the commitment to name something that I'm going to get a lot of pressure and pushback. There's a reason that even when in those moments when we recognize something is really racially problematic, many of us don't actually speak up. And that's because we want to avoid conflict, right? We don't want to ruin sure. the dinner. Why would we ruin the dinner? Because generally the person we are going to try to talk to about it is not going to respond well. And that functions to keep people from doing it, which, of course, protects our positions, right? None of this is benign or neutral. And that's what that's trying to get at, that you are breaking with what sociologists call white solidarity. And white solidarity is the unspoken agreement amongst whites that we'll keep each other comfortable around our racism. We won't, you know, call each other in. We'll cringe, you know, when we hear a friend say something, but we don't want them to feel bad. And so we'll opt for silence and protection. But in doing that, we're actually saying your comfort in this moment is more important than the impact that racism has on people's lives.
Do you think, Robin, it's always easy to determine when racism is happening?
No, not at all. I mean, there are really explicit, obvious things. But, you know, my focus is actually on what I would call white progressives. And I don't mean that in terms of Democrat or Republican, but probably your listeners, right? Well-meaning white folks who would never, ever want to, you know, participate in racism, right? And I think we're actually the most challenging because the degree to which we think we're good to go just because we're against racism, we tend to put our energy into making sure you understand, you know, here's all my qualifications and evidence for why I'm not racist. I mean, gosh, I marched in the 60s and my grandchildren are multiracial and, you know, all of this, you know, these qualifications I might give you. That's where my energy goes, right, rather than on what it really needs to be doing for the rest of my life, which is deep personal reflection and action. So it's the more, and I put air quotes around subtle, I mean subtle to us as white people, it's the more subtle forms that are very hard to see but are so insidious that make, I often say that I think one of the most hostile environments for people of color day in and day out is unexamined whiteness. It's just that water. It's the way that my assumptions and my responses are there when you try to talk to me, but it's very hard to get your hands around or to push back on. Is that clear?
Yes, it is crystal clear. As much as this whole topic can be crystal clear, we're going to welcome phone calls for Robin. Robin DiAngelo is our guest this hour, and we're talking about what it means to be white. We're talking about racism, issues of race in this country. She does very interesting work. She's a former associate professor of multicultural education. Her scholarship is in whiteness studies, and she is the author of What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy. She's also author of Everyone Really Equal? An Introduction to Key Concepts in Social Justice Education. We've talked a little bit about schools. She also says, and I want to move into this conversation in just a while, she talks about our culture, and she says any white person living in the U.S. will develop opinions about race simply by swimming in the water of our culture. Mainstream sources, schools, textbooks, media don't provide us with the multiple perspectives we need, and our socialization renders us racially illiterate. We'll ask her to amplify on that. And we'll go to your phone calls. We have many of them coming in. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And we'll be with you in just one moment on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. Many of them are coming in. Mike in Greenbush is our first caller for you, Robin. Hi, Mike.
First, on an optimistic note, sociology professors said that racism is learned, which gives me hope that it can also be unlearned. The next point is I didn't understand that the Native American, which I considered, you know, black racism, red racism against Native Americans, was genocide until I spent some time studying in Germany, and a German student said, well, your Americans, you know, basically committed genocide against the Native Americans, wiping out 95% of them, which is true. Some of it was disease and other things. And I didn't know that until someone from a different country pointed out to me, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. But the third point is that I think it's interesting, anthropologically, the cradle of civilization is in Africa. And anybody who knows a little bit about anthropologies, the Homo sapiens were the ones that were remained in Africa, and the Neanderthals moved to Northern Europe. So essentially, my ancestors from Ireland and all the other Anglo ancestors are descendants of Neanderthals, which tells us that the genetically superior race, intelligent-wise, are the Homo sapiens who originated in Africa.
Robin.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. And I actually agree with you that it is learned and that it can be unlearned. And I think it's your example of learning when you went to Germany kind of is a great reinforcement of that point, that we just aren't given the information we need to have the complex, nuanced understanding necessary to really address what I think is the most complex, nuanced social dilemma since the beginning of this country.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more. It might be a good time for us to talk about these mainstream sources that you've written about. Our textbooks, our media not providing us with the multiple perspectives we need. What do we need? Where are they falling short?
Well, I mean, probably the very first thing we need is not to live segregated lives. And there's a really powerful message I want to add to that. Of segregation. It's not just that we don't know what's going on. It's that we are not taught to see that as any form of loss, right? That I could literally live my whole life and go to my grave without knowing people of color in any deep way or any variety. And no one's ever conveyed that I've lost anything. And so the fundamental message is that there's no inherent value in the perspectives or experiences of people of color. And we're certainly not given those perspectives, in schools or in our textbooks. So I'll give you an example, Jackie Robinson's story.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We all know he's famous for, you know, what did he do? He broke the color line, right? That's the phrase. And it reinforces this idea that he was really exceptional and really special. And finally, you know, there was one that could do it, that could, you know, was good enough to play with us. And we celebrate him as if he himself managed to do this. And can you imagine if the story went like this? Jackie Robinson, the first black man that whites allowed to play Major League Baseball.
Right. It's quite different,
because
isn't it?
It didn't matter how good he was. If he didn't say he could play, he couldn't play. And if he walked on the field, literally the police would remove him from the field. And so we don't tell the history in a way and it's not just so that I can see how bad white people are, but I need role models too, right? Who were those people that fought to change those policies and practices? How did that happen? That's information that I need as a white person, in addition to the reality of, you know, how things have been. But the way we tell the story always puts the onus on the victim, basically.
Mm-hmm. And how little we know about all the Negro League players who played for years and years and were spectacular, many of them. We don't know them at all.
No.
Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. Joelle in Nina. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to add to that, as a person of color, sometimes the insidiousness of that layer of murky racism where you're not sure if people are being racist or not, it's insidious, and it feels sometimes like you're going crazy because you're like, are they being racist right now, or am I being overly sensitive? And I feel like I lived in New York City for many years, and now I live in Wisconsin, and I feel like a lot of the racism now is like after the election has been allowed to be loud. So I've been able to experience Wisconsin in a totally different way than I ever have before, because I feel like the lid is off. And at the same time that I hate this administration, I'm also grateful, because I believe that it's time that we have an honest conversation with each other, because as people of color, we have been saying how unequal it's been all along. And because we haven't had a seat at the table or not enough of a representation, no one has listened. But people like the professor are kind of the bridge to that, because we need white people to tell other white people what white privilege is and how it affects people of color in everyday lives. And even though I'm an educated person and I'm upwardly mobile and I'm queer and it's 2017, sometimes, you know, when you delve into a very homogenous, segregated society like I live in at the moment, it feels like it's 1952. And I've learned things that growing up in San Francisco and living in New York City, I had never learned before.
Robin.
Yes, thank you. Well, first, you are not crazy. It's real. And that's part of that kind of that unexamined whiteness that's so toxic and hostile, is she is left constantly to wonder. And then if she were to raise the issue, most likely it would be exceptional for a white person to acknowledge that, yes, that was racism. And so you're left with that, is this me? Is this worth it? I mean, it takes, honestly, hours off people's lives. And so for the first thing I actually want to say on behalf of my people, on behalf of white people, I want to apologize to the caller. You know, it's real. It's us. It's our problem. And do know that I've committed my life to trying to wake other white people up and have us, you know, stop the nonsense. And I don't expect in my lifetime to be free of my conditioning. I still, you know, say and do things that are problematic, but much less so, which means much less harm to people of color. And I have the skills to repair those moments. And that's a really key piece that I wish white people understood is, people of color know that we've internalized these really problematic, racist worldviews and assumptions and patterns. They know that. What they're looking for is when we expose those in those moments, and they take that incredible risk to try to talk to us about it, it's actually a moment of trust, right? They're opening themselves to a risk that rarely goes well for them. And what they're looking for is repair. And if we could just drop the defensiveness and just be there to bear witness and to take responsibility for what happened and move forward, the relationship could actually be deeper than it was before. What often happens is we respond so poorly that they just stop talking to us. And then we think, oh, everything's fine, when indeed it's a much less authentic relationship. Mm-hmm. Than we think that it is.
Thanks, Joelle, so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Are we looking at all at a generational issue here, Robin? We hear about the millennial generation perhaps having more interaction with all kinds of different people. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but we seem to hear that there's less racism, less people being judgmental among those who are young in our society than those who are older. Is there truth in that?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, again, just keep looking at our outcomes. Across every institution in this country, there's racial inequality and racial disparity. And I think we all recognize that. So our narratives have changed, right? Colorblindness, open-mindedness, all of these things. And yet our outcomes have not. And in fact, I don't think the younger generation is any less racist, the younger white generation. Sociologist Joe Fagan did a study where they had hundreds of college students keep journals across the semester of every racist moment, incident, comment that they were witnessed. And there were just thousands and thousands of them. The difference is, and probably two key differences, people have learned to do it behind the scenes. So white people don't tend to make those comments in front of people of color, not the really explicit ones. And that idea, that good, bad binary, I often open my workshops with a quote from a student. You know, I ask them to reflect on some of the ways in which their race has shaped their life, what messages they've received, how diverse their neighborhoods were, and the quote I use is a student saying, well, I grew up in a mostly white neighborhood, only went to mostly white schools, but the only message that I've ever gotten is that everybody's equal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, there's a huge contradiction there. And, of course, when they're writing this to me, they're writing in a class that's almost 100% white, and they're sitting 10 miles from a city that's 57% black and,
right.
So that they could pull off that narrative in the face of such separation. I mean, maybe that's the difference, and that they only can be bothered to write three lines, and that basically those lines say the same thing over and over. Nope, I was only ever taught that everybody's equal. And, of course, that's patently not possible. You can't teach, in other words, I was only taught to treat everybody equal, but you can't teach that. Human beings are not objective. So I think the narrative has changed, but I don't see it as any more transgressive than Archie Bunker's narrative.
Hmm.
You know, not in pre- practice mm-hmm. at all. They still live segregated lives. Sometimes because some of their heroes are people of color, there's this false sense of relationship, right? So, you know, in my bedroom, I have all these posters, you know, Michael Jordan, Beyonce. And so there's a sense of relationship that I don't actually have in my real life.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, no, I don't think when we die off, the racism
everybody, it'll all be gone. Yeah. Justin in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
Hey, great conversation. Thanks for having me on. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with the basic concept of what you're trying to get across here. I think that, in my opinion, sometimes the media in general, as a general sense, is kind of to blame for perpetuating racism by only showing negative about these colored communities throughout, you know, all you see on the news is negativity. And then I pose a question to you is, do you think that possibly this might be more of a human condition because humans have been segregating each other, and with our differences of religion, color, race, everything, you know, since thousands of years ago, as far back as we can, you know, examine human culture?
Yeah. Oh, I have two thoughts of that. I mean, one, race itself is a relatively new idea. And as the first caller kind of made the point, is we make up these reasons for difference, right? That they vary across cultures. And again, racial difference, the way we think about it today, didn't even exist in the past. A lot of people think that it's a very, very old idea and that people have always been uncomfortable with difference. Well, actually, early people couldn't travel far enough in their lifetimes, you know, to be able to actually see the kind of physical differences that we see now and associate with race. So while we may have always kind of ascribed various meanings to difference, those meanings change, and that gives me hope. And sometimes the question that I use to guide kind of my analysis, because true, false, nature, nurture, those are really, really difficult questions, right? They're perennial questions that I don't know that we can ever sort out. So the question that guides me is, how does it function, right? How does that narrative function? So while it may be true that people have always dominated, who's most likely to invoke that narrative in a question of inequality? Usually those who are dominating, right? People of color don't usually say, well, somebody has to dominate. It's natural. So, you know, I guess I ended up on the bottom. It's a narrative of those on the top. And for as long as I will grant that it seems human beings have always struggled with, you know, power. But for as long as we've struggled with domination, we've struggled with justice, right? It is as old and natural to strive for justice as it is to dominate. So that's where I go. I want to be on the strive for justice side, and try to remember that ideology serves the dominant. So for me, I reject it.
Thanks, Justin, for the call. Matt writes, the election of our first black president allowed a shift of racist attitudes from the color of one's skin to a more socially acceptable vilification of the Democratic Party. The backlash against Barack Obama led to not only the election of Donald Trump, but to the gerrymandering of huge segments of our population and a Supreme Court that will represent conservative interest for decades. Robin, how do you respond?
Talked about my work on white fragility, but that I define it as the lack of capacity to endure challenges to our, you know, what we have been taught we're entitled to. And I think 8 years under a black president, there was incredible umbrage at that. I'm going to use the term uppityness, right? Like, it just exploded the lid, as somebody used the term, the lid off of what isn't really that far below the surface for white people, which is this kind of deep resentment and anti-black sentiment. I mean, one positive thing is it's not deniable anymore. I mean, my goodness, are we not post-racial, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think this really virulent eruption of racism was the response to, you know, how dare you lead me, basically. Hmm. Yeah.
And yet, when you look at the way that he led, it would be hard to say anything other than he was a very smart, he's still alive, a very smart man who was very slow to anger, who reasoned things. He's a constitutional lawyer, for heaven's sake, who had this family who was just so engaging and two dogs who were cute as could be. I mean, it was this really American kind of family in the best possible way. It's hard to juxtapose that with a feeling that many have had about him when you look at who's occupied the White House before and the personality of the person who's in the White House now, too. I mean, holy cow, what's going on?
I know. I think it's straight up racism. Yeah,
really?
He was amazing. He was, you know, he's brilliant. He walked that line that no white politician has to walk on.
Yes.
How he navigated it, in the same way that Hillary Clinton would have to navigate that gender line in a way that, you know, no male has to navigate it. And yet, fundamentally, I think it's about racism. That incredible resistance and determination to undermine him at every step. I mean, it started with the birther movement. All of that was pretty blatant. And it's not rational, right? It's not, obviously, it's not rational.
Let's go next. Thanks, Justin, for your call. Eddie in Green Bay. Hello, Eddie.
Hey, what's going on? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What's up, Robin? Eddie Moore, Jr., White Privilege Conference.
Eddie! Yay!
Hey, just wanted to ask you, because as you're talking and you're explaining anti-black sentiments and really some of the historical pieces, I'm thinking white supremacy, not racism. Yep. So I was just wondering, could you talk about how you explain those two terms differently, and the difficulty in people receiving understanding of those terms and your history with talking to folks about that? And then secondly, as a parent of white parents, of white kids, sorry, if you're talking to white parents of white kids, one, how early do you introduce conversations about this? If they're asking you about that, and what are some tips you give them, white parents working with white kids, so that they're not receiving this information so late? And if you could close out, if there's time, with just how you got started. How did you go from wherever you were in the beginning to where you are now? Thank you again. I look forward to hearing your response.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you, Eddie. Oh, you set me up really nicely. okay, let's start with racism. Most people use prejudice, discrimination, and racism interchangeably, but they're different things. Everyone has prejudice and everyone discriminates. I mean, we've got tons of research on this. That's that implicit bias piece. We've got the bias. We act on it often in unconscious ways, but it's measurable. So we can remove the word reverse from that discussion. All humans have prejudice and discriminate. When you back a group's collective prejudice with legal authority and institutional control, it's transformed. And then no individual has to do anything. The system is set up in a way that will advantage the group that controls it. The example I often use is white women got the right to vote in 1920, and there was only one possible way for us to get it, and that is for men to give it to us. We could be prejudiced and we could discriminate one-on-one, but we couldn't literally deny men's civil rights. They could, however, deny our civil rights. That's a very significant difference that has to be acknowledged in language. And in fact, of course, by definition, it's deeply embedded, historical, and it's not fluid. So, of course, today they could still deny us our civil rights and are working on doing so. White supremacy is the deep idea and all of the norms and mechanisms that flow from it of white as ideal, white as superior, white as the human norm, and all others as a deviation to that ideal norm. So white as supreme. And I believe we live in a white supremacist culture, and that the relentless messages of white as ideal. And research also shows that children by age 3 to 4, all children who grow up in this culture understand that it's better to be white. Hmm. That's white supremacy. And in fact, I'm writing a piece right now on why I will use that term. I think it's an incredibly descriptive term. It's a sociological term, and it beautifully describes the culture we're in and how we all internalize that culture and those messages and frameworks, of course, with different effects. I don't know really how to tease out right now the difference between racism and white supremacy, but the way that racism, maybe I'm getting it right now. If we were in China and they do oppress the Tibetans, and if they do that by race and they have the mechanism to do it, then we would call that racism. And it wouldn't be based on white supremacy in that case, right? But here in the West, it is based on white as ideal. And it has been exported worldwide. So there is a layer that affects all of the world because we've exported our images worldwide. Of the 100 top grossing films of all time, worldwide, now think about the influence our movies have on the world, 95 of those films were directed by white people and 99 of them by men.
Really?
Yes.
It's amazing.
That is a profoundly homogeneous worldview. They will tend to also be upper class white men, just given their position. They're the least likely to have a wide variety of sustained cross racial relationships, and yet they get to write the stories and disseminate the images. And that's how white supremacy gets kind of disseminated all through the culture. It's one key way.
Mm-hmm.
So how early with kids, honestly, from the beginning, as early as you can, right? I mean, I really believe that if it's integrated into how you see the world, it's going to be part of how you talk to your kids and what you talk to them about. Notice most parents of color, and I think black parents in particular, know that they have to talk to their kids about racism. And they need to do it fairly early in order to keep them safe and then also in order to keep them with some sense of self-worth. Because they're up against a culture that's relentlessly sending them messages that they're not as valuable or as worthy. And white parents should also start just as early, because who's going to grow up to be the people perpetrating those messages that are impacting children of color, right? And there's so many materials out there that tell you how to do it. I don't know that I have time here, but I like the analogy that a colleague of mine, Darlene Flynn, uses, which is when you're on the airplane and they say you need to put your oxygen mask on and then turn and put it on to more vulnerable people.
Mm-hmm.
I think white parents need to have their oxygen masks on. They need to have done their deep work and be able to hold the conversation. And it will come to them, I think, fairly naturally how to talk to their kids. But if white parents haven't addressed their own discomfort, they're not going to do a good job. They're probably going to, one, want to romanticize children as innocent of race. And I remind you again, the research shows by age 3 or 4, they know. And they're going to probably go to that colorblind kind of stuff, right? Everybody's the same. So those are my thoughts on that. And then do we have time for me to speak?
Yes, go ahead. That'd be interesting to hear.
One of the reasons that white progressives are my specialty is because I am one, and I totally get how we think. And I applied for a job as a diversity trainer in the early 90s and thought it would be super cool and fun and interesting, and I was qualified because I was a vegetarian, you know? I shop at the food co-op. I'm kind of making fun of myself a little bit, but that idea that just being, you know, open-minded, liberal, qualified me to be talking to people about racism. And I applied, and I got the job. And right away, I was working with people of color who were challenging my worldview. And part of being white is I could be a complete adult with a college education, a parent, And never in my life had my worldview been challenged racially, my racial worldview, and certainly never by people of color in any sustained way. It's part of what it means to be white. And so I was like a fish being taken out of water. So that was the first key piece, is sustained relationships with people of color who were challenging me, and who, in relationship with them, I was also seeing what they experienced. And then going into the workplace, which was almost all white, and trying to talk to white people about racial inequality. And, wow, white people are very difficult on this topic. And I was like a deer in headlights up against the hostility and the anger and the resentment to discuss this. Even being in rooms filled with white employees who would be bitterly complaining about reverse discrimination and affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And you're looking around going, I don't know what you're talking about. This is not rooted in any reality that you're having. There's no people of color in this whole workplace. And at first I was frozen in the face of it, but years and years of it, and then the sociologist in me, I just got better at figuring out how we pull that off. And, I had enough of it myself to be able to draw from. But also was kind of getting a new worldview, and could speak back to it. So that's what got me here. Growing up poor and female also really helped, because I understood that experience of oppression. But I also understood that it didn't exempt me from benefiting from somebody else's. And so when I was up against a piece of racism I didn't understand, like maybe somebody gave me some feedback and I couldn't figure out what was problematic, I would just imagine the thing that I had just done coming from a man towards me. And then I would be, oh, my God, I see it. It's so clear.
Interesting. We need to pause for just a moment, Robin, and we'll return and we'll take a couple more phone calls. Professor Robin DiAngelo is our guest this hour. She is the author of What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy, also author of Everyone Really Equal, an introduction to key concepts in social justice education. We'll return to your calls in the minutes that we have remaining in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to more phone calls in the couple minutes we've got left. Gail in Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Really good show today. My one concern is the global. It's the fact that no matter what race, no matter what country, we still have inequality for women. We still have disrespect for an entire half of our human population. And I really believe that until that changes in every race and in every country, we will still have these issues, and we will see it as racism, we will see it as prejudice, because you've got to take your self-decorum and your respect to a relationship with an opposite sex, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, no matter what religion, no matter what country you live in. That's it.
Robin.
Yeah, thank you. I feel as passionately about sexism and patriarchy as I do about racism. And I also know that I am a white woman. And as a white woman, I can perpetrate racism against women of color. And that I do. White women are no easier on women of color than white men. Our racism towards them tends to come out a little differently. But we still perpetrate it. And the recognition of that is called intersectionality, right? That I occupy multiple social positions and that they intersect in complex ways. And so, yes, I absolutely think that patriarchy is worldwide and that it needs to be addressed. And I know that I can collude with white supremacy and racism. And that has to be looked at. And it's one of the ways that coalitions amongst women across race and class are have been challenging, is because white women kind of just, hey, we're all women. And it's like, no, there's not a universal woman's experience, that my race, my sexuality, my class, my ability is going to shape how I experience my gender and how I express it. And I can absolutely perpetrate all other forms of oppression, even as I experience sexism and patriarchy.
Hmm. And on that note, we've plumb run out of time. Robin, thank you very much. Interesting hour. Oh. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Robin DiAngelo, our guest this hour. Her latest book is What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy. She does workplace consulting in the issues of race relations and racial justice all over the country, former associate professor of multicultural education. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this show before he left us, and thanks to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for your contributions and for listening. Until tomorrow.